And hello there, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, March 28th, 2018. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guests today are John Dufresne and Susan Henderson. First up is John Dufresne. John is the author of six novels, including Louisiana Power and Light and Love Warps the Mind a Little, both New York Times Notable Books of the Year. He wrote two short story collections, The Way That Water Enters Stone and Johnny Too Bad, as well as three chapbooks. And he has two books on writing and creativity, The Lie That Tells a Truth, A Guide to Writing Fiction, and Is Life Like This, A Guide to Writing Your First Novel in 6 Months. John was one of the 13 authors of the mystery novel Naked Came the Manatee. His short story, The Timing of Unfelt Smiles, was included in Miami Noir and Best American Stories Mystery Stories 2007. Another short story, The Cross-Eyed Bear, was included in Boston Noir and Best American Mystery Stories 2010. John was a 2012-13 Guggenheim Fellow and teaches in the MFA program at Florida International University in Miami. Hey, John.
Hi, how are you?
Great to have you on.
Great, thanks for asking.
Yeah, let's begin by talking about Flash and your inspiration for Flash, writing the very short story.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it began probably when I was teaching myself how to write back in high school, and I wrote poetry first, and then I liked reading fiction. I thought I would like to write what I like to read. So I started writing stories, and they were very short. They didn't have a name then, a snappy name like Flash, but they were short stories that I could begin and end, you know, get to the end of it and do some revision and feel good about it. So I taught myself, I guess, how to write short stories by writing these things that were very short stories, and then taught myself to write a novel by writing more traditional short stories, and went from there. And I think writing short stories in many ways is more difficult than writing a novel. It doesn't take as long, but you're always taking things out and refining and distilling. And in some ways, it's both harder and more rewarding, I think, writing short stories. Anyway, I started getting my undergraduate students into writing, and so I thought, well, I'll just start them out the way I started with these very short stories. And I had been a fan of Norton anthologies that James Thomas and others did, Flash Fiction Forward and Sudden Fiction and all of that. So I used that as sort of an idea. And Microfiction that Jerome Stern published, he used to do a contest every year when he was at Florida State, the World's Shortest Short Story Contest, and I would have my students all enter it. And the prize was a carton of oranges, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it was fun to do all of that, and they liked writing them. So it just became something that, I was interested in teaching. You got good response from the students because we could do it quickly, get some confidence, take a look at what you have, what you still need to say, and all of that. So, that's how I got into this. And then, you know, after teaching it for 3 years, I asked my editor at Norton if she would mind if I tried to do a book based on what I was teaching here at FIU.
So, you know, you said something that I've been curious about in terms of, you know, the shortest short story possible.
Right.
And, you know, I'm a reader of Amy Hempel and Lydia Davis, and, you know, they have some stories that are one sentence long. And so how do you write a really, like, a one sentence story? What is that?
Well, I got some, but I can't read it. But yeah, I'm just looking at her. Well, here's one, actually. So, you mentioned Lydia Davis, and I mentioned her in my introduction. Amy Hempel, I'm a great fan of hers, have been for years. So, yeah, this is like, how short can you push it? How short can you make it? So I talk about her, and then I have a Merle Drown, who's a Flash fiction writer almost exclusively these days. He started out as a novelist, and he's a friend of mine, lives up in Hampshire, and he wrote this one sentence story Suffused with Pleasure, the title. She bit him quick, sharp, precisely, and before he knew it, he said, I love you. So what it does is really point, the plot is elliptical. It's not on the page. It's just, this is a love story, and this is how it developed. And we, sort of it gets us as readers started, you know, it's almost like haiku. It gets us started thinking about what the story is and imagining who these people are. And it's kind of like the call that awaits its response. I like personally like stories with a little more narrative. Excuse me. But Lydia Davis is, some of them are kind of like aphorisms, prayers. But all of that counts. If it's revealing character or expressing theme, if it's, you know, in some cases there is a plot in flash fiction. If it's exploring the plot and the themes on it, then I think it's a story. And it asks the reader to do more work. All stories, I think, are collaborations between the writer and the reader. The writer begins it, the reader finishes it. And in flash fiction, the reader is asked to maybe to do more work than usual. So.
You included so many short stories in your short stories in the book, and you know, so many wonderful ones. I laughed out loud at Before We Do Anything Else by Leonard Nash.
Oh, I did too. I love that story.
That's like one of my favorite stories now.
Oh, that's great. I will tell him. Leonard happens to be my neighbor. He was a former student of mine, so he'll be pleased. I love that story.
You know, let's talk a little bit more about the very short story or flash fiction, especially for writers who are not, I mean, I think most short story writers at this point are familiar with the short form, but there are still some that are not. And you say in the book that it may prove to be the ideal fictional form for the 21st century. Will you embellish?
Yeah, it's, this is becoming an age of distraction. And when we seem not to have time to do those things that we want, that we used to be able to do, not to sit down with a book and lose ourselves in it. We're always, you know, just working with our mobile devices, our phones and our iPads and all those things, our computers. That we're called away from, our attention is called away from the page. So there's that. It's like while the devices are connecting us to the world, they're also distracting us from it. And those devices also, on those devices, like an iPhone or an iPad, you can get an entire piece of flash fiction on the screen at one time. There's the whole deal. So I think it's attractive. It will be attractive. And it's, the market for it is like exploding. When I was writing, more than I even knew, when I was writing this, I Googled, I guess it was just flash fiction markets, I guess. And as it says, in 0.55 seconds, I got 719,000 hits.
Gosh.
Yeah, for flash fiction markets. And Duotrope, which is kind of a clearinghouse for... Yeah. Patients.
Yep.
They had 4,700 publications looking for flash fiction. And some of those publish a story every day, 365 stories a year. That's one place. So your chances of getting published are certainly better than your novel, finding a home for the novel. So it's a good way to break into the world of publishing, to get your name out there and to earn the endorsement of editors, introduce your beloved characters to an appreciable number of readers, and all that kind of stuff. So if your dream is to write a novel, this might be a good place to start writing. Get yourself out there and learn about what this business is about. And maybe you'll often get feedback from, you know, in the comment section of these stories. I mean, what people think about your story. And hopefully people will be generous and specific readers and let you know what they think and help you craft better stories. It's like that. I mean, I still love reading novels, but, you know, during the school year, I'm distracted by everything, by student papers, by teaching, by trying to write my own stories, all of that stuff. It does, sometimes I just want to, like, let me just get a story here. Put down, you know. So I think it's, for this age of distraction, I think it's probably a good way to go.
So, you know, we talked about the short being, you know, as short as a sentence. What is the general length that they're looking for?
It changes. Trying to think, like, I've seen, well, one sentence ones. I've seen places that wanted 50 words for a story. I think when Flash Fiction, the first Flash Fiction anthology came out,
yeah,
if I remember correctly, I think they had it at up to 2,000 words. And I think subsequently in the second and third volumes that it was maybe 1,500 was kind of the maximum. And I think so. I think something like that, anywhere up to 1,500 words is a Flash Fiction, I guess. somewhere in between. It could be a sentence long, as we talked about already. I guess that could be. That could be a long sentence, of course. Not necessarily the quick one that I read before. But,
Okay. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with John Dufresne. His new book is Flash, Writing the Very Short Story, published by Norton. So you have written all. You have written short stories, novels, everything in between. Mm-hmm. How do you know when an idea of yours is a short, a long short story, or a novel?
Yeah, I think I know it's a novel right away because I get sort of a community of characters. I see them walking around in a place, and I know there's going to be a lot of subplots and complexities and things like that. So with a short story, it's a little more difficult. I start with an idea for a short story, and as I'm writing it, maybe because of the way I write, which is I don't know where it's going when I start. I just have a character that I find compelling and intriguing, and I give that character a lot of trouble, and then I kind of muddle ahead and see what he does, she does, and so what happens is the stories very often open up that I thought it was going this way, but no, it's not. It's going that way because I got to know the character and realized that she wouldn't do what I thought she was going to do, and that's even better. So I have this idea that there's a story that you set out to write and then one that you write, and the one you actually write is better than the one you set out to write because you have the benefit of knowing the characters and whatnot and the world and what your themes are going to be. So those stories tend to, sometimes I think they're going to be short and they end up being longer than I thought. If I'm going to write Flash, I set out with that in mind. This is going to be 3-4 pages, that's it. I'm just going to do this. Some of those stories, what I was fooling around with, I think I have a couple, or at least one in the book of my own, which is taking sort of models, non-literary models from the world and applying them to literature, like, a business memo, and turning a business memo, writing a story that's not about business, but in the form of a business thing, or a resume, or I do a math problem, a word problem in here. So taking those, and I know they're going to be short because it's set up that way. It's advertising, turning those, you know, television commercials, working with that form, so it's going to be short. You know, television commercial lasts 2 minutes, so that's how long your story should take to read. So that's a little easier. The short stories themselves, they're more traditional ones, the ones I'm not quite sure of sometimes. Sometimes they want to become novels, and I'd say, well, I'm going to try to rein that in. You can only work at one novel at a time. I can't.
You talk about how flash fiction, with its word limits, may be the limit writers need to think creatively and write imaginatively. And as you just said, you know, write a business memo or write a story in the form of a business memo without it being a business memo, or do something else, play with another right. form. Will you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's writers, I think, are always trying to impose limits. It's not about freedom. Writing stories, it's about limits, it's about limiting yourself, it's about setting up parameters. It's like if you think of poets decide, you know, say, well, I'm going to write a sonnet has a form, and the form is 14 lines, 5 beats in a line, and it rhymes in ABAB, all that. And so that's completely arbitrary. Somebody somewhere decided that's what it's going to be, and we've been doing it ever since. But there's no reason for that, logical reason to make it 14 lines. But what it does is help you think differently than if you're just going along writing something about love, for instance. You have to think ahead when you're writing a song. In the same way, the toughest thing for a writer to face is the blank page. You open it up and there's nothing on the page, and you've got your pen in your hand, and you don't know what to do, or you've got the blank screen on your computer, and it's like, what do I do first? So, to get away from that tyranny, what flash fiction does is say, okay, you've got 1,500 words to do this. And that might get you, it's all you need to get you thinking in an unconventional way. You want to think unhabitually when you're writing stories, not to be logical and rational. The more constraints that you impose on yourself, the more that you're free to do, to create and to imagine, to set your imagination loose. And the arbitrariness of the constraints helps you be more precise in the execution of your story, I think. You get to experiment that way, too.
Yeah. I noticed that when I'm with my students and I give them a prompt or an exercise, that I do it as well, that it's somehow more easier, as you say. It's just easier to get the story on the page without it just being so open-ended.
I visited a high school last week down here in Miami, I go there every spring. I go there to do this one class on, I did flash fiction. I usually just talk about writing anyway. And I went in there and I gave them some prompts. I said, here. And after I talked to them, I said, write this. And one of the prompts that I'm remembering now was why I am afraid of, and then blank, and you fill in the blank, right? Mm-hmm. And then the prompt was, write 12 sentences beginning with because. And this young, I think, like a sophomore in high school, she wrote this thing. We were crying in the classroom. It was like about afraid of her grandmother dying. 4 lines. And that wasn't even sentimental. It was just like this. My mother will crumble because my, you know, all this. It was like, oh, my God. In about 4 minutes, she did this. And there were other kids doing the same kind of thing. One other kid on that same exercise said, why am I afraid of confrontation? And so he said, because people won't like me. Because, you know, he did this whole thing, but they were so open. You know, they just exposed themselves to, you know, to each other and to this stranger. And they had no trouble. They just started writing. You know, they only stopped when I told them to stop. So it is easier to do that. And it's easy. You can make mistakes. It's not like, you know, you did it in 5 minutes. What do we expect? You always get back to expect. In my cases with these kids, amazing.
You know, the short story, it's been around for a long, long time, and it was once a staple of mainstream magazines, and then it fell out of favor. Why do you think that is? Did people stop appreciating the short story form, or did journalism sort of take hold? What happened?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I know that you know, those of us who went through creative writing programs, you know, MFA programs, as I did, traditionally, it's always, you learned, workshops are always about short stories. Because, you know, you could get a beginning and middle and an ending to talk about revisions, you know, all of that. narrative techniques and whatnot. So it's harder to do that when you're getting pieces of a novel. So I think for me, it was like that's what I learned, and I love doing it. And I learned how to write was doing these stories in a workshop, and people were always saying nobody reads stories anymore. I said, well, they're going to get a lot more because that's all we're all writing. And I will say that I think publishers favor novels. I'm told all the time that novels sell better than short story collections, and I'm sure they're right. There's no reason for them to lie about it. And they kind of, you're encouraged to write the long form rather than the short form. I still read it. I mean, the New Yorker stories, and not just the New Yorker, but my favorite writers, Alice Munro and William Trevor, you know, almost exclusively write.
Mm-hmm.
Not Trevor so much, but he writes both, but writing short stories. I just love that. I'd love to be able to write like that. I'm still trying to learn how to do that. So I think it's there. I'm not sure. I think there's probably less space. I used to write short stories for a magazine called Yankee.
Yes, of course.
And they were great. They published a bunch of things I did, and they were very nice. And so it was like the first time I had a personal relationship with an editor. She liked my stuff, so she would ask for more, and I would just give it to her. But it became, sometimes you could tell, she'd say, cut 3 pages. And I'd say, like, being funny, I'd say, what 3? Because I wanted to get in there, they actually paid money.
Right.
But it was like she said, we don't have enough ads, or we've got too many ads, or, you know, it was like, so the commercial part of it was determined how much room, how much space they had for stories in the particular issue. So I know that has, at least with the commercial magazines, it's probably important, and they seem to have less space for fiction.
We are at the end of our time. I wonder if you would leave our listeners with a few pearls of wisdom.
A few pearls of wisdom. Now, who am I talking to? Writers? I'm talking to writers.
You're talking to writers, yeah. You are.
Pearls of wisdom. I wish I had them. what I do when people say, and this is, everybody says this, so I'm not, you know, how do I become a writer? What do I do? You sit down and write, and you write every day, and you carry a notebook around with you, and you write things down, and you only leave the house to get material. You're looking for images and pieces of conversation and all that. You're looking for the stories. That's where the stories are, out there. So you go out and find some material and bring it back and you write. If you keep a notebook with you, you're serving notice to the world that you're a writer and to yourself that you're a writer. And even if you don't get to sit down for an hour or 3 hours today, you're telling yourself, and I'm a writer, and that's why I have this notebook, and I'm out here looking for material, and it's everywhere. And note-taking is a creative act. It's not just jotting something down. And don't write about yourself. Write about the world out there. Look for the material and the characters and whatnot out there. And so you start, you know, you see, this happened to me, so I'll use this example. A waitress, this was in Bozeman, Montana. I was with my wife and son, and years ago, and we were in there, and this waitress waited on us in this little cafe, and she had something about the way she looked attracted me. She had a kind of like curly blonde hair. She had a pencil pushed into it. She had like a poodle skirt on, aqua socks, white sneakers, and I think a black sweater. I just wrote down a couple of details. Well, I started, you know, that evening, when I started writing that, I kept going, and I said, where does she go when she gets off work? And I wrote about her house, and I wrote about her cat, and I wrote about, you know, her life. And she became a character later on, just from wanting to put down a little note.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, if you're a writer, you start creating things immediately. So I find it helps me. So keep a notebook, I guess, and write every day.
Yeah, that's great, because when we're out, we see things, hear things, and we tell ourselves we're going to remember it, right? And
exactly.
We never do.
Nope. This is so good, I won't forget. And then you get, oh, well, what was that? What happened? Like with dreams.
Yeah,
if
with
you don't
dreams.
Write it down, you walk across the room, it's gone.
It's gone.
So, yeah.
John, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you.
And well, thank you. It was great talking to you.
I love your book. It's
thank you so much.
It's wonderful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was John Dufresne. His book is Flash, Writing the Very Short Story, published by Norton. And I do love it. I have all kinds of pink highlighting going on through the pages. So check it out if you're into short stories, even if you're not. It's a great book. Stay with us. We'll be back with Susan Henderson after the break. Don't go anywhere.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just a thought of you, ooh, turns my whole world misty blue. Just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Oh, I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just a thought of you,
just a thought,
my love, my whole world.
To Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. First half, we were here with John Dufresne, author of the new book Flash, Writing the Very Short Story, published by Norton. We are back with Susan Henderson. Susan is a 5-time Pushcart Prize nominee and the recipient of an Academy of American Poets Award. Shorter work has been published in The Future Dictionary of America, McSweeney's Books, 2004, The Best American Non-Required Reading, Houghton Mifflin, 2007, Not Quite What I Was Planning, 6-Word Memoirs by Famous by writers famous and obscure, Harper Perennial, Drinking Diaries, published by Seal Press, Create a Writer Platform, published by Writer's Digest, as well as a number of magazines and newspapers. In 2009, Susan attended the Squaw Valley Community of Writers Workshop on a full scholarship. She lives in New York and blogs at the writer support group litpark.com. She's author of the novels Up from the Blue, published by HarperCollins in 2010, and The Flicker of Old Dreams, published by HarperCollins this year. And that book is the focus of our talk today. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Barbara. I'm so glad you invited me.
And I'm so happy to have you, and you'll be on my panel at Literary Orange in a couple of weeks. And I love this novel. I just love it. And I would love to hear you talk about how it came about.
Oh, okay. So The Flicker of Old Dreams is about the death of small-town America, as told by a mortician. And it came about, I would say these past few years I've become increasingly alarmed by the growing gulf between one American and another. And in particular, I was feeling the split between my current life in New York and my family roots in Montana. And so I started to think a lot about the town where my father grew up and where we used to visit as a kid. And I wondered if visiting there might help me put my finger on what was happening. So my attempt was to go there and listen and, in a non-political way, see if I could figure out what this was about, this fissure.
That's interesting because, you know, the setting is a funeral home. Your main character is an embalmer.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was so interesting to me because at first glance, I wasn't sure how the novel would affect me, how involved I would become. And pretty much immediately I got drawn right in, and I probably read it in 2 days because I I loved it. I loved the situation. I loved the setting and your characters. Talk about making the main character an embalmer. Do you have firsthand knowledge? Or if not, how much research did you have to do?
Well, so the research started by, I went back to this tiny little town where my father grew up called Winnet. And it's a town of fewer than 200 people. And I stayed there for a month. I was the only resident of the Hunter's Lodge there. And for a month, I was without a cell phone, without an internet access because of the nature of the town. Couldn't use a credit card. My room didn't have a landline phone or a TV, so it was just totally cut off. And I was just wandering around this town listening and saying yes to anything I was invited to. And the longer I stayed there, and then in particular when I got back to New York, I started feeling like I was witnessing a death, the death of a town and a way of life. And so I thought, well, who would be the best person to narrate this book about death and dying? And I brainstormed a whole lot of things, and at some point I came across the idea of, like, oh, what if someone from a funeral home narrated the book, because she could look death in the eye, and she could look at the parts about death and the struggle against an inevitable death that are not pretty, and she could also be comfortable and compassionate and offer dignity to this story. So it just sort of kind of came to me one day. And I have no experience at all, so I, you know, immediately went on the internet and fell into all kinds of rabbit holes about the funeral industry, and did probably a year's worth of research before I started writing.
Interesting. Were you working on other things while you were researching?
No, I felt like I needed to get comfortable talking with the authority of being an embalmer. And so I didn't just study embalming, although I know everything about it. Now you do too. cotton balls will never be the same. So I watched YouTubes. I listened to surgeries and autopsies happening. I spoke to morticians and just felt like I needed to get to a point where I could really be, you would believe that I knew what I was talking about.
Well, I sure did. And but what I'm struck with are two things. And one is that you have a strong stomach. And the second is that you have a lot of patience, because I think, you know, writers, we get these ideas and we want to write it. We don't want to spend a year on research. We want to, you know, get right to it. And as you've proven with this book, your research has so paid off. I mean, it's just, yeah, I was sure you had some sort of, you know, funeral home background and had family. There was an embalmer in your family, and it's really kind of interesting. But so much patience. Can you talk about that, just having patience as a writer?
Yeah, I feel like I'm an impatient person by nature, but it takes me a long time kind of wandering around a story to feel it. I was drawn to the setting first, like I often am, and I knew my story was in that setting, but I'm never someone who's like, oh, I want to write a story about whatever. So I was just kind of like, almost like just turning over rocks and thinking the story will come, the story will emerge. And I find when I try to hurry ahead of that, like I get a good idea or you see a popular book and you're like, how can I kind of play off of this idea? I always just run really quickly into a dead end. So my way of writing is actually not doing a lot of writing. I get really intimate with my material. So during this book, the entire time I was in that town for the month, I had writer's block, so I wrote zero words. I wrote a few things about the wind, so that was it. And then when I came back, to me, the nature of writing a novel is about keeping it interesting for the 3, the 5 years that it takes to write it. And so I would go to calf taggings, or I would watch movies about snowstorms, and I would count that as my writing time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I actually, I do all of my writing walking. So I come up with like for this book, I would think, okay, there's two people who I want them to run into each other, and I wonder how that can happen. So I'll leave the house with that. Just that in my mind. And I'll just go walking, and I'll say hi to neighbors and look at birds and, you know, sweat a little bit. And my thing is that I won't go home until I've written the scene that answers my question.
Hmm.
And then eventually at some point I get my phone out, and I've got a little app. It's called the Audio Memos app. And at some point, if I just keep the question in my head, I'll get the scene will come. And then I just talk it out into my phone.
Interesting. And then you go home and you transcribe at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And how
mm-hmm.
does it change then from the audio that you recorded to, becoming a typewritten manuscript?
Well, it's interesting because, one, I'm kind of writing in collage. I often like several sessions on my phone before I listen to them. So I'm always surprised how many times I have the same idea over it again. But I write better speaking. And then I find if I'm just typing, I get kind of caught up in the visual of the words and like, oh no, I've used this word 3 times already, and I just kind of get jammed. But when I'm transcribing, sometimes it's like a half hour of stuff that I have to transcribe, and I just put it in as it is, but it starts to become alive hearing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't don't know. I feel like it grows. Like if I do a scene in my phone, then when I think the scene is done, I'll walk a little bit more. There's something about walking that makes my brain work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll walk a little bit more, and then pretty soon it's like, oh, I know where they're having this scene. And then that, you know, the background comes in. So a lot of times when I'm transcribing these, they're really, it's like a patchwork quilt of ideas that touch, but they're not sequential. And I just find it's fun. It's just kind of like playing with clay.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I don't think I know any writers that do it that way.
Supposedly, Walden was written like that.
Huh. That's so interesting. I'd love to hear you read from The Flicker of Old Dreams. Would you do that?
Okay. Let me find my glasses.
And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here with Susan Henderson, who is about to read from her new novel, published by Harper Perennial. Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to read from the first scene when we see Mary's workspace, where she does her embalming. And we've just come down the stairs into the basement, and she has a guest there, Mr. Mosley, waiting for her. The dead come to me vulnerable, sharing their stories and secrets. Here is my scar. Touch it. Here is the roll of fat I always hid under that big sweater, and now you see. This is the person I've kept private, afraid of what people would think. Here I am, all of me, scarred, flabby, covered in bed sores. Please be kind. When a body comes to our funeral home, it comes draped in a white sheet. The sheets begin clean, but soon they carry the essence of the one who died, first in silhouette, the contour of the nose, a valley or mountain at the stomach, the feet turned slightly in or out, the bumps of shoulders, breasts, chin. Before I move the sheet aside, I study this landscape. At first glance, it is like a field covered in fresh snow. Then the details become more visible. Just as the field of snow, upon closer inspection, shows signs of the life that has tramped through it, so will the sheet show something beyond its surface. There are smears and drips, a spot of blood from where the IV was removed, a stain from loose bowels not thoroughly wiped, the sticky smear of saliva, the gray shadow of one final sweat. I pull back the sheet and welcome Mr. Mosley to the bright white silence of my workroom. Take his cold hand and hold it gently in my own. His face, neck, and hands are red and toughened from years of working in sun and cold and wind. The rest of him is quite pale, soft. I don't often get to know my neighbors until we meet this way, and that is the case with Mr. Mosley. His wrecked body lies on the stainless steel table, a faucet near his head, a drain near his feet, and there is much to do, but first, this, his hand. Here is the man, nothing to hide behind, no sheet or uniform or name tag. This is the man without his possessions, with chores left undone, with mistakes he can't make right, with nothing more he can prove. I'm right here, I tell him. It is what I have longed for my whole life. Perhaps everyone longs for this, just to be, and to have someone stay near. He does not complain that my hands are clammy. There is no pressure to be charming or clever. We are simply here together in this quiet. And I'll stop there.
Thank you so much. That was Susan Henderson reading from The Flicker of Old Dreams, published by Harper Perennial. It's interesting. Mary, the narrator, treats her artwork as an art form, and mm-hmm. she is so respectful of her guests, as she calls them, and she's able to remain distant until Doris, and Doris affects her like none of her other guests have affected mm-hmm. her. Could you talk a little bit about that and about Doris and Mary?
That's interesting. Doris was my favorite character in the book. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that you found her. Doris was the one who taught both Mary and me a lot about life. So she's terminally ill. She's dying of lung cancer, and it's kind of an awful last while for her. And she's an artist who does paint by numbers paintings and is very inspired by George Bush's painting. And so she teaches Mary, who is so Mary is someone who feels judged and disliked and unimportant in this town that has this very strong identity, a strong sense of who you should be and what you do in your free time, and she's just kind of not like them. And so a lot of times she doesn't get to know her neighbors until she sees them in her workroom, you know, under this white sheet. And so I feel like for her, feeling different from her neighbors causes her to shrink and keep quiet about her opinions and her passions. And then she meets Doris, who's just very upfront about, they have a conversation about how they'll do her hair after she's died, and the things Doris is ashamed of, like a scar that she's going to find. And I feel like through Doris, we both learned not to live so cautiously and to step out of the boxes others have built for us, to listen more closely to our instincts. And my favorite thing is as she's coming to her last day, she's like, I wished I'd worn my best jewelry. I kept saving it for a good occasion. And I feel like she's reminded us to wear our best jewelry, even if it's just an ordinary day.
Yeah, that scene, I think it's pretty much way into the book. Maybe it's chapter 37. Mm-hmm. It's so emotional, her dealing with Doris as her guest. Mm-hmm. I loved it. Talk about poetry's influence on your work.
Well, so I began as a poet, and strangely, sometimes the first, when I feel like a book is coming on, I'll hear it in meter, but I won't know what the words are or even what the topic is. So I probably spend most of my time writing what I call the shape of the book. I think of it in the shape of a poem. And I work and work and work. You must have noticed that I'll put periods, and I'm very liberal with incomplete sentences because I want to force you to stop and to breathe where I want you to stop and breathe, because the rhythm is as important to me as the plot. Often if I have a run-on sentence, it's because someone's nervous or because someone's running or trying to catch their breath. And so I feel like when I first started writing poetry, I had a lot of success with it under my maiden name. And I felt so ashamed of the work that I published because I read so much that I know how good you can get. And so when I first saw my poems in print, I never wrote poetry again. And I actually never wrote again for almost 10 years because of the shock of seeing something in print. And then I read Camus and Dickens and, you know, Toni Morrison and Baldwin. And it was just like, oh, no, I can't write again. But so I've never written poetry since then. My biggest award is still, you know, from when I was like 21 years old. But I read mostly poetry, and when I'm in the final stages of editing my work, I read poetry out loud before I edit, just so my ear is kind of tuned to something more musical.
Interesting. It's really interesting. We have so much more to talk about. We'll have a lot to talk about on that panel in a couple of weeks. But before we go, though, I wanted to ask you about the point of view that you chose here, the first person past tense mm-hmm. point of view. Why was it that way from the start?
I can't hold my own attention if I write in third person. It's just kind of a flaw with me not being able to connect with the character. So I wrote in first person past tense, and then I put it into third to try, and also to see if I could get all of the to be verbs out of the book. So I put it into third to kind of force myself to pick better verbs,
mm-hmm.
and then I put it back into first. And I didn't mean to tell it in present tense, but it just sort of wanted to be in present tense.
Mm, that's right. That's right. It is in present. Interesting. So that's really tedious to do it that way.
Yeah. I'm all about the tedious. I actually totally enjoy really laborious projects. So I probably flipped it back and forth from third to first a few times, just to kind of keep cleaning the weeds out of it.
Mm-hmm. That's great. That's great.
It's funny you called me patient, but in that one way, I'm patient. I like doing just like mind-stopping, tedious tasks.
Yeah. Well, no, two ways, because you spent a year on research.
That's true.
That has a lot to do with patience. I mean, you weren't working on anything else. You were just researching. I find that really interesting. Anyway, before we go, any advice for the writers listening?
Oh, let me think. Mostly read. Read fiction and nonfiction. Read poetry, short stories, bestsellers, classics, just to see all the ways that you can work with words, all the different ways you can go about themes. And then you just have to trust that you're the only one who can tell your story. You're the only one with your unique voice and your unique life experience. So even if it's a topic that's been handled a lot before, you're bringing your voice to the choir of writing. And I don't know, I just have a lot of respect for each of us finding part of when I record my voice while I'm walking, the reason I feel like I get a better story that way is I think sometimes we write, and other times, if we can remember what our natural voice sounds like, a lot of times we'll get to the heart of our work better.
Hmm. Yeah, so true. So true. Writing, writing it as if you're writing a letter to somebody or mm-hmm. somehow, an email even, right?
Right, or even you write like you're whispering a secret to someone that you love or to someone that you fear. And I feel like our speaking voice carries all of our vulnerabilities and all of our kind of courageous and unique quirks.
That's good. Well, I really look forward to extending this conversation when I see you at Literary Orange. Thank you so much.
Yes, I can't wait to see you there.
Yeah, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. It was Susan Henderson. Her book is The Flicker of Old Dreams, published by Harper Perennial. Two books today that I love. It's great. So many books to love, right? In any case, all you writers out there, stay in the chair and get your writing done. And Literary Orange is in a couple of weeks, April 7th. It's sold out, but if you have tickets, I'll see you there. And Susan will be on my fiction panel a couple of weeks after that, the LA Times Festival of Books. I have a panel Sunday at 12:30, I believe, with Louis Uria, Margaret Patterson, and Peterson. I think that's her last name. Shoot, this is a new author I'm not familiar with that I can't wait to read. And Lisa C. So the LA Times Festival of Books schedule is up on their website. And I think free tickets need to be acquired the week before to make sure you get into panels. And that happens the week before. In any case, gotta go. See you next week here, or Marie will see you here next week. And write well, stay well, and I'll see you soon.